R-I-C-K.
Derek Jensen. Say it again, please.
Derek Jensen. J-E-N-S-E-N. But before I jump into him, is there any anything left over from last week? Any further thoughts about Rhianna Eisler?
When I saw a guy at the bookstore, I picked up two of the Power of...
A whole other world here. Have any of you read or heard anything about him? This is a...
I Googled it.
Okay. So here he is. Here's Derek Jensen. We'll pass this around. Nira, I told the class this is my version of high-tech teaching of a laminated picture.
He looks like John Travolta.
Well, when there's a movie made about his life, then, yeah, John Travolta.
He looks more like his brother, actually.
All right, so fasten your seatbelts because Derek Jensen really is going to take this to a whole different level. He's a very radical thinker. But first I'll tell his life story, which partly explains why he's the writer that he is. He was born in 1960, and he's always lived in the western U.S. I don't know exactly where he was born. I think Colorado, but somewhere out there. But he's lived in Idaho, in eastern Washington, in the Spokane area, and then for the last 20 years, I don't know exactly. He has lived in far northern California, I think up near Eureka or Arcata, but in a small town. But he travels a lot. He goes around speaking and advocating and joining protests and things like that. I got to see him at University of Vermont a few years ago. He got his first degree at the Colorado School of Mines, so he has a degree in mineral engineering, which he was studying before he got into the radical thinking that he did. But then he got an MFA in creative writing, and that was the first career he had was teaching creative writing in a community college and also in prisons. And he's written about that experience and his thoughts about education. But then he left that and he tried beekeeping for a while and homesteading, and for the last few years he really has made his living by writing. And he's produced a number of books, probably the best known and the thickest, it's two volumes, it's about 800 pages, is called Endgame. Came out in 2006, and that's Endgame refers to the fact that our civilization is entering its final stages, according to him. His other books include The Culture of Make-Believe, A Language Older Than Words, which I'll be quoting from, and then his most recent is called The Myth of Human Supremacy. He's got a few others out as well, but those are the main ones. The book came out a few years ago that is a collection of his key writings, and that's a good place to start with him if you're not totally horrified by the time we're done here today. It's the Derek Jensen Reader. Writings on Environmental Revolution came out in 2012. So that's a good place to dip in. But let's get back to his biography. The defining feature of his life, and you'll see how this plays out in his thinking, is that as a child, he and his siblings were physically and sexually abused by their father. He had a really rough childhood. So his struggle to come to terms with that really fueled his work. And he writes very openly about it. Most of his books they're extended essays. They combine autobiography and commentary, and then he brings in some historical and statistical information to back up his ideas. But largely, he is working through his rage and his feelings about the world. And here's one thing he says about that. With no notion of what a peaceful family or a peaceful culture might have to offer, I am now a refugee from my own childhood. We all, human and non-human alike, are refugees from the war zone that is civilization. Now, you can look at his experience and how it affects his writing in at least two ways, and I don't know which is the correct interpretation, but on one hand, you could say that you have to take his ideas with a grain of salt, because after all, he's just expressing his own angst, and that's how he sees the world, so we don't have to take it quite that seriously. If his ideas are uncomfortable, that might be how you choose to see it. Another way to look at it, though, is that he has nothing to lose. He was so sensitized to pain and suffering in the world that he sees things and is willing to say things that most of us aren't. And for that reason, he's worth reading and listening to. So take your pick. I'm not going to suggest which is the better way to interpret him. But here's what Kurt Cobb says about him. Kurt Cobb is an environmental activist. Have you heard of him? I don't know who this is, but this seemed like a very apt description of Derek Jensen. He is so keenly attuned to the natural world that he feels every knife cut civilization inflicts on it. With every word he speaks, he seems to be saying, if you could feel the earth's pain as I do, you would spend every moment of your existence trying to stop it. An abusive home life seems to have led him not to the provinces of psychology, but to those of sociology. He does not ask what type of monster his father was. He asks what kind of society produces fathers who are monsters. His answer has led him to the conclusion that fathers can't be fixed until civilization is fixed. So as you read through Jensen, he is constantly reminding you of all the atrocities that are committed or condoned by civilization. So he talks about massacres, genocide, vivisection, slavery, child abuse, sexual violence, war, Holocaust, deforestation, exhaustion of soil, air and water pollution, and more. He's constantly keeping that in front of our consciousness. Like, this is the world we have created. Look at what it's doing. So again, either you say he's just playing out his own pain, or you read it and you say, gee, at last, here's somebody who's not afraid to name everything that is done by what we call civilization. And the best way to place his work in a intellectual context, he's among a small group of writers who are often called primitivists, or neo-primitivists, or anarcho-primitivists. That's anarcho as in anarchism. The other well-known writer, well, relatively well-known in this field, is a guy named John Zerzan. I love saying his name. It has two Z's in it. John Zerzan. Maybe I'll say it again. Jensen is similar to Zerzan and a few other of these primitivist writers. And what they're saying, unlike Wendell Berry or Rhian Eisler, they're not saying civilization has pros and cons and we've made a few mistakes, let's go back and fix them. He's saying civilization itself was a mistake. That human beings were much happier and could be happier again living in tribal hunter-gatherer societies. That psychologically, biologically, that's really what we're fitted for. And this whole idea of living in a technological world where we manipulate nature, where we have hierarchical societies and have a race for dominance and wealth, it's all wrong. We need to get rid of it. We need to take down civilization.
Ron,
yes.
Before I forget.
Is the institution that really came in and ruined it. Jensen doesn't focus so much on the state. He's going back even further. So as I read him, I have to wrestle with this. So now what do you do? Like, what do you do with that information? Are we really going to go back to hunter-gatherer society? It doesn't seem very likely. So Jensen is someone you read to, if you really want to wrestle with these questions, like how have we gotten here, and now what do we do? And his solution for how we get out of it may not be very practical, but he's raising questions that I think are worth asking and worth wrestling with. So let me get into the specifics of what he writes, what he wants us to think about. His first major point, or his underlying point, is that humanity is immersed in nature. We are creatures, we are animals, and we're part of the global ecosystem, and a local ecosystem, and that all of our attempts to think of ourselves and to act above nature or against nature, or we're better than nature, we can improve upon it, those are all in error, and they all lead to destruction. That we have to think of ourselves as being immersed in nature. And he backs this up with a lot of stories from his own life of being in communion with other forms of life. He talks about communicating with animals. In the myth of human supremacy, he talks about the research on plant consciousness. So he's not coming from a mystical, totally off-the-wall point of view. He says, here's evidence. Here's what people are finding. Here's what I've experienced in my own interaction with the natural world. He says, and this is a quote, "The natural world is full of intelligence and knows far better than we do what it is doing." And I think that kind of captures his thinking in a nutshell. It's similar to what Wendell Berry was arguing when he talked about our ignorance, right? We can be very scientifically astute and we have all this great technological power, but in the final analysis, we really don't know what we're doing because nature is so complex, so deeply interconnected, we can't possibly grasp it all. So Jensen is extremely bothered by the fact that our civilization is based on this myth of human supremacy. We feel that only humans have intrinsic value and any other species are just there for our benefit, that we can use them as resources. He says, "We pretend we are not animals, whereas in reality the laws of ecology apply as much to us as to the rest of God's creation." And he puts God's creation in quotation marks because he's not much of a religious thinker. He sees religion as another manifestation of civilization. "We pretend we're at the top of a great chain of being, although evolution is non-hierarchical. The great chain of being has long been used to rationalize whatever hierarchies those in power wish to rationalize. It has been used to rationalize the divine right of kings, to racism, patriarchy, and empire." So once we set up this hierarchy, we apply it within society as well. And so some human beings are more valuable than others. You can justify slavery or genocide or gross inequality because those people, those others, well, they're not really human, or they're not fully human, or they're not as good as we are. So hierarchical thinking is central to civilization, and it starts with our sense of being above and better than other species. Our power of reason and abstraction separates us from having this authentic connection with nature. He is highly critical of how we experiment on animals, how we domesticate animals, how we treat other other beings justified by our scientific and economic belief system. And even those who do show some concern for the environment, some percentage of environmentalists themselves are often motivated by the need to preserve resources, that we can't lose this species or this ecosystem because we humans need it. And he's calling for full respect for the other species' right to be on the planet. They have as much right as we do. Any reaction to that before? Jensen believes that. Jensen is arguing that, but he says that in the meantime, we're doing horrific damage to nature and to ourselves. And we will make ourselves extinct if we continue what we're doing, and nature will, in the end, reclaim the planet. But it will be diminished in many ways, depending on how much longer we continue what we're doing. So,
if there's any planet left.
Well, yeah, I mean, there'll be something left. Might be a cinder. But, he does argue that this goes way back to the earliest times of civilization, and we'll get to a little more specifically what he means by civilization. But he, like other of these authors, believes that there was an acceleration of this damage, of this worldview, this destructive worldview, in the 1600s. So the scientific revolution took the already existing separation from nature and sense of dominance over nature and really strengthened it, really gave it a strong force. So here's what he says about how this happened. He's talking about Descartes, the French mathematician Descartes, but others at the time, like Francis Bacon, were also implicated in this. Because life is uncertain, and because we die, the only way Descartes could gain the certainty he sought was in the world of abstraction. By substituting the illusion of disembodied thought for experience, by substituting mathematical equations for living relations, and most importantly, by substituting control or the attempt to control for the full participation in the wild and unpredictable process of living, Descartes became the prototypical modern man. There's another author I've always liked, Morris Berman, who wrote a book 30 years ago called The Reenchantment of the World, and he focuses on Isaac Newton and talks about the same kind of process of disembodied knowledge and stepping back from an experiential understanding of the world and how that really ruined our culture. Berman is very very strong on that point. Jensen says that science has become an arrogant, imperialistic cultural narrative. It likes us to believe that it's privileged access to the truth, the objective truth. So by using science, we know how nature really is. But he says that's just a mythology. It's really based on a desire to exert power over nature. And it's a self-fulfilling way of thinking. So we find that we can exert power over nature. Oh, therefore science must be a true way of knowing nature. But Jensen argues there are other ways to know reality that involve more of a relationship, a give-and-take relationship, where you're listening to other living beings rather than imposing your desires on it. Indigenous cultures are able to live in harmony with their environment for thousands of years at a time, whereas the scientific technological worldview is killing the planet within a few centuries. So he says, which way of knowing is true? Which way of knowing has more wisdom in it? And then he says, how can members of a species who considers itself the smartest on the planet be so stupid? Is it possible to be more stupid than to destroy the planet we live on?
Oh, man.
So this is maybe a more pungent way of asking the question than Wendell Berry. Remember, Berry talks about our ignorance, but he, remember that one quote where he said, we're not so destructive because we're stupid, it's because we're intelligent but don't know the limits of our intelligence. We have the intelligence to create this great havoc in nature. It's not that we're stupid. But Jensen goes one further and he says, "Yeah, oh yes, we are. We're it must be awfully stupid to act the way we do." What I want to cover is not in itself all that exotic. I think we would all agree with what he's saying here. He points out that the industrial economy, the industrial society that we have now, is not sustainable. It can't keep going much longer. He says a civilization built on non-renewable resources cannot last indefinitely. Economists and other leaders of the current economy tell us that there are substitutes. All of these vital resources we use, from copper to petroleum to whatever, there can be substitutes. If we run out of one of them, we'll find something else. Jensen says, no, there will come a point where you just cannot substitute. The earth cannot support this way of life indefinitely. So he says, here's a quote, "It should be clear to everyone by now, even those with a vested interest in ignorance, that industrial civilization is killing the planet. It's causing unprecedented human privation and suffering. Unless it's stopped, or somehow stops itself, or most likely collapses under the weight of its inherent ecological and human destructiveness, it will kill every living being on Earth." There's a broad statement of what he believes. And by the way, he says, the system is not going to stop itself. So it's either going to collapse or we need to take it down. That's what he argues. The logic, the inertia, the worldview that gave rise to this system, there's nothing in it that has any sense of self-restraint or awareness that it's reaching a limit. There are no limits in that worldview. So it's either going to collapse or we've got to bring it down. The hyper-consumerism that makes our way of life is predicated on the exploitation of human and non-human resources, in quotation marks, the exploitation of these resources worldwide, who pay with their own misery to create monetarily cheap consumables. This is a reference, although he doesn't use the word, to the externalized costs that we saw in Wendell Berry. And we'll be seeing it again. So this idea that our way of life, all of the things that we consume, all of our technologies, even the good stuff, even our medical advances and our arts and music and everything, there's a hidden cost. When we produce these things, there is some environmental cost somewhere, or there's a cost to the laborers who are making it possible. That are not built in to the financial, or he says the monetary cost of something. It's hidden from us. And like Wendell Berry, he says that because we have a global economy, because it has tentacles all over the planet, we can get whatever we need. If we want fresh strawberries in January, we can get them. They just come from somewhere else. And we pay money for that, but we don't cover the other costs that are involved. He says this creates an infinite, insatiable demand. We think we can have whatever we want. If we're not tied to a specific place, if our economy is not local, but it's diffuse and it's global, then there's no way for us to recognize the damage we're doing. There's no way for us to give back to the land, to be in relationship with the land. We're just consuming. And because money is itself is abstract, there's no limit to money. So you can be a billionaire and still feel you don't have enough. You need more. And you can have more. There's no end because it's an abstract quantity. So he uses the Buddhist metaphor of the hungry ghost here. He says, like hungry ghosts, we eat the world, but it is never enough. If you're not familiar with that metaphor, Buddhism talks about the psychological sense of endless desire, like always wanting. No matter what you have, you want something more. And it turns us into hungry ghosts. We consume constantly. We're always eating, but we're empty. We're always empty. We're just spectral beings that can never be at home. And Jensen says that pretty well describes how we're living on the planet right now. Heavy-duty stuff, huh? Our culture rewards ruthless individualism. So first it separates us from community. It separates us from each other, and then it rewards that identity of individualism. It rewards the amassing of power by those with pathological needs to dominate and control. So the people who rise to the top in the corporate world or the political world, the military world for that matter, their drive for power and control is excessive. There's a wonderful documentary about the corporation as an entity, and it says when you look at all the characteristics of the behavior of corporations, if this were a human being, you would diagnose them as a psychopath. Because, this is a quote, because our cash economy is predicated on the idea of society composed of atomistic individuals pulling in selfish directions, it can do no other than reward selfish behavior. Communal behavior is not rewarded in this system, which means the cash economy can do no other than destroy communities. Now let me stop there, because in my other... couple more quotes on this topic. The needs of mass production, a funneling of resources toward producers, is in opposition to the needs of the community, a siphoning of resources toward the poor. So long as we value production over relationship, and in fact over life, so long shall we follow our current path of ever-increasing immiseration for the ever-increasing majority. So that sounds like communism. But again, he's going beyond that. Here's what he has to say about corporations. Corporations are institutions created explicitly to separate humans from the effects of their actions, making them, by definition, inhuman and inhumane. Corporations are effective tools of the wealthy, he says, because they kill at great distances. Those who profit never have to see the devastation they cause. So corporations grow huge as forests grow small. That's in a book that he co-authored called Strangely Like War, which was a radical environmental critique of capitalism. To expect corporations to function differently than they do is to engage in magical thinking. The specific and explicit function of for-profit corporations is to amass wealth. The function is not to save salmon, nor to respect the autonomy or existence of indigenous peoples, nor to protect the vocational or personal integrity of workers, nor to support life on the planet, nor is the function to serve communities. So the corporations were set up for one purpose only, and that purpose for profit externalizes all the costs and all these other goods, all these other things that make life possible and desirable are brushed aside.
Was it true that in the early...
To read Jensen, even though he's terribly depressing, he really lays it out. He gives us very stark choices. And maybe things are more subtle than that. Maybe there are halfway measures that we can try that'll work. But he says, look, here's our what it really comes down to. We have to choose between civilization on one hand or sustainable local cultures. We have to choose between industrial production or healthy ecosystems. And then here's this quote, we can't have it all. The belief that we can is one of the things that has driven us to this awful place. To believe a finite world can support infinite growth, much less infinite economic growth, where economic growth consists of converting ever larger numbers of living beings into dead objects, is grotesquely insane. Every once in a while he comes up with these great little turns of phrase.
Like grotesquely insane.
Grotesquely insane. Not just insane.
That's who's in the White House. Grotesquely.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I was reading in
I made this point, but just in his own words here, the hatred that characterizes our system is not a product of biology. People are not fundamentally hateful. It's a result of the unquestioned assumptions that inform us. In other words, our culture. So there's a ray of hope in his saying that we're not.
And unquestioned.
Thing Jensen says often in his writings. This is a great phrase. He says, "I sit here writing about this, but I really need to be out there blowing up dams." Mm-hmm. And he comes back to that every once in a while. He'll say, "Why am I doing this? I need to go out there and blow up a dam."
Oh, he's Hemingway-esque.
Well, not really. He never does it though.
Oh, good.
He hasn't actually done it yet.
Yet.
But he says, look, we've got to stop the system before it kills us. Why aren't all of us out there? And that's blowing up a dam is just a metaphor for taking the system down. But I think ultimately he, like I myself, feel the first task is just to ask these questions. Let's talk about these unmentionable difficult things and realize what it is we're up against. Then we can act out of that knowledge.
And that's where the community comes in, because you have those feelings of
to say we're inherently good, because obviously we've done so much damage. But he, like all the other authors, is saying if we could live in balance with nature again and live with respect for other living beings, and as you said, be influenced by nature, we wouldn't be so bad. We don't have to be as destructive as we are. We've gotten entranced by a certain set of cultural beliefs, a certain set of assumptions, a worldview that is for a couple thousand years, but more so in the last 300 or 400 years, has been pushing us into this destructiveness. And we go around and around in circles, we don't know how to get out of it. So even when we say, oh, well, let's stop using fossil fuels, we'll have wind energy. Well, okay, that's great, but it's still the corporate economic system, someone's making money off of it, it's still spoiling the environment. So we're still going around in circles because of this worldview that we're trapped within. So that's where he's saying it's not natural, it's not biological that we're this destructive. It's the worldview.
Someone wants to say something because it goes back to this comment that you said before about.
So my next point then, the next thing that I drew out of Jensen, here's how he characterizes civilization. This is how he defines what he means by it. Civilization is a system of dominance rooted in violence. So actually this speaks to Kit's point that is there always going to be hierarchy and dominance? Jensen is saying not necessarily, that it's a product of civilized thinking. So we civilized people use the term as a kind of in a self-congratulatory way. Like, oh, we're civilized. We have all these wonderful amenities, and we're educated, and we do all these things so well. We're the wisest human beings ever, right? That's what civilization means. And Jensen says, no, it doesn't. It means a culture that revolves around the power and voracious appetites of cities. That's what a civilization is. It's when you start concentrating population in cities and they need the resources of the surrounding land. Wendell Berry suggested this in his work, but I think Jensen says it more explicitly. Cities, the defining feature of civilization, have always relied on taking resources from the surrounding countryside, meaning, first, that no city ever has been or ever will be sustainable on its own, and second, that in order to continue their ceaseless expansion, cities must ceaselessly expand the areas they must ceaselessly hyper-exploit. And he says this need to expand, this hunger for resources, is the source of genocide, colonialism, imperialism, and the exhaustion of the natural environment.
He does speak in broad strokes,
doesn't he? Broad strokes, yes.
Genocide, imperialism.
And then he goes on and says, to pretend that civilization can exist without destroying its own land base and the land bases and cultures of others is to be entirely ignorant of history, biology, thermodynamics, morality, and self-preservation. And it is to have paid absolutely no attention to the past 6,000 years.
Thermodynamics.
I already read that. Okay, now he takes the gloves off. As if he ever had them off. Follow the rise of civilization, and necessarily you follow the outward path of an expanding circle of death.
Oh,
cheery.
But it might be true.
and again, for our economics textbooks to be accurate, they would need to be printed in blood. The blood of indigenous peoples destroyed so their land could be taken, bought, and sold. The blood of salmon, beaver, and buffalo, commodified and killed for the money they have come to represent. The blood of slaves and wage slaves who spend their lives toiling so their owners may have the leisure that is the birthright of every human being. Civilization originated in slavery. It's based on slavery, requires slavery, would collapse without slavery. Slaughtered and caused extinction among animals because they've been commodified. It's wholesale. It's industrial scale. That's his problem with this. And maybe that would be his response to your point, is that, yeah, there's always going to be friction. There's always going to be attempts to dominate and take more. But at least it'll be on a smaller scale. It'll be within a culture that doesn't reward it so much, doesn't push it so much. I don't know. Is there ever a utopian ideal that's possible? Maybe not. Couple more things done, and then we'll break. Here is a place where, if you want to call him a communist, this would be the place. He talks about how having access to land is essential if we're going to have an independent, self-sufficient life. And of course, that's what Thomas Jefferson was all about, right? Was every independent landowner would be the basis for a democratic society. But Jensen says that one function of civilization is to restrict access to land, that only a favored few get access to it. And that comes back to the enclosure movement. That's what that was all about. So here's what he says about that. If you can force people to pay just so they can be alive on this earth, nowadays these payments are usually called rent or mortgage, you forced them into the wage economy. The same holds true for forcing them to pay for materials the earth gives freely. To force people to pay for things they need to survive is an atrocity, a community and nature-destroying atrocity. So is he asking for communism there or something deeper than that? I think he's asking for a communal, primitive tribal society where everything is held in common. There's no there's no private ownership, and everyone is taken care of because they're part of the community.
And then there's no.
He is reflecting on. I think he's reflecting on what the Sierra Club did, but maybe 15 years ago or so. I think the board of the Sierra Club got taken over by some people who were really, really concerned about overpopulation. And they said, in order to keep our American environment protected, we have to keep out the immigrants. It was this very strong anti-immigrant push in the Sierra Club. It didn't last very long because I think they got forced out. You maybe remember this?
I remember it probably.
Well. Yeah, so in response to that, he says, wanting to close the border to people yet leave it open to the theft of their resources, and then in parentheses, importation is the preferred term in polite society, is to show that your alleged concern over population is nothing but a cover for continuing the same old bigotry and exploitation. I don't want you, but I do want the coffee grown on land that used to be yours. So he's sympathetic to, I don't know what to call it, you know, to cultural diversity. He's not joining this movement for closing the borders. But where did the question come from? Well, they're escaping systems.
Famine
or oppression or you know, systems that aren't working. Well, if you didn't have these hierarchical systems, people would tend to stay where they are. Their local culture and land base would take care of them.
No.
No? Here's the system we've got. Here's the multi-layered structure that we've got. How do we get out of it and get over there? And that's the hard question. But the first step is just to acknowledge and understand this is the system we've got, and here's what it's doing. So let me just finish up on this point. As he's defining civilization, why does he call it a system of domination? He says civilizations are set up so that the people on top are authorized to use force. Force is legitimate when the authorities use it. For the rest of us, if we try to use violence to protest, we're put down. So violence only flows one way in civilization. He says, the property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control by destroying or taking the lives of those below. He talks about listening to the voices of the people who are crushed or oppressed, and also to the natural voices, animals and the land itself. We need to acknowledge the full scope of the destruction and the pain before we can move forward. So I think he's speaking from his childhood experience here of not being able to speak about what was happening to him. And so he sees that in the world. He says, civilization doesn't want to hear the voices of its victims. And that's what he wants us to start doing. Maybe that's where I'll end.